Hello and welcome to the Oldie Podcast. I'm Ferdy Rouse, the Oldie's digital editor. On the 7th of April, it will be 250 years since the birth of William Wordsworth, one of the fathers of romantic literature in Britain. Today, we're joined by the author and journalist Francis Wilson, who has written a piece in the latest issue of the magazine about Wordsworth and his home, Dove Cottage, in the Lake District. So, Francis, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
So, can you tell us a bit about Dove Cottage?
Well, it was originally a pub called the Dove and Olive Branch. And then when Wordsworth and Dorothy moved there in 1799, it was known as Town End. So it was only called Dove Cottage in the 19th century. And so I'm interested in the fact that in this sort of the new refurbishment they've done of Dove Cottage, they haven't sort of refurbished it to the point of giving it its original name.
Hey, that does seem rather bizarre, actually. But so how big was the refurb? Was it... what went into it?
Well, I only know what I've read, and I think they've turned it all into a kind of virtual experience.
I suppose, as in which case, they don't need to do too much revamping then, I suppose. Just leave it as is and sort of let the goggles do the rest.
Well, it was always... I mean, I spent a lot of my life visiting Dove Cottage because my grandmother lived very near there in the Lake District, and so I went there a lot as a child. And then I've written two books about Dove Cottage, and so I went there a lot, been there a lot as an adult as well. And it didn't need any work doing to it, as far as I can see. It was very, very well preserved, and it had this wonderful museum attached to it. And so I'm not quite sure what all this money's gone on, but I gather it's gone on making it into the Dove Cottage experience.
So have you always been quite close to Wordsworth because of that proximity to Dove Cottage as a child?
Yes. No, it was the first... Dove Cottage was the first writer's house that I became really interested in.
And as I understand that, he lived there with his sister.
Yes.
What was life like for them there?
Well, it was a kind of idyll. I think they lived... I mean, they lived there as young adults. They lived there as hippies, we call it now, I think. But I think they felt as if they were reliving a childhood that they'd lost, that they'd been deprived of. Because William and Dorothy were separated when they were very young after their mother died. And Dorothy was then sort of sent off to live with an aunt in Halifax, and William and his brothers stayed with their father in Cockermouth. And they weren't—they didn't meet each other again until they were in their late teens. At which point they sort of fell into each other's arms. I think. I mean, it was very, very moving for them, especially for Dorothy, who had had this childhood completely separated from her family, even at Christmas and birthdays. Mm. And she was born on... Christmas was her birthday, actually. She was born on Christmas Day. And so I think she felt as if not only had she lost her mother, she'd lost her brothers and her father and her home and everything. And it was... You know, she was damaged by the experience, of course. And so when she re-met William, they were absolutely determined to never be apart again and to, you know, to live together in a kind of ideal way. And so this cottage was a kind of fantasy for them, really, of a life they'd been deprived of.
Mm. Their relationship's quite interesting, isn't it? I mean, there's you mentioned in your piece that they were almost like a married couple, in a way.
Well, they did live like a married couple. And I am interested by... I mean, I am interested in what was strange and curious in their relationship. But also, I mean, brothers and sisters were much closer then. And we can see this in Jane Austen's novels, where sisters adored their brothers. You know, and brothers adored their sisters. And there was a real sense of kind of no one is good enough for them. And I think because social lives were much, much smaller. So there was a kind of... There was a kind of devotion and clan loyalty. But obviously with William and Dorothy, it was slightly more complicated because they had been apart as children, and there was this kind of huge attraction between them. And quite famously, when William got married to Mary, who was one of Dorothy's closest friends, he also, just before he married Mary, made vows to Dorothy as well, slipping the wedding ring on her finger too. So it was going to be three of them in this marriage. And so when I say they lived together like man and wife, I mean they really did live together like man and wife, and Dorothy went with them on their honeymoon and, you know, sat between them on the coach.
Was that not a bit awkward?
I think it must have been very awkward. I think Mary Wordsworth's wife was an absolute saint to put up with this sister who was very, very possessive and obviously highly neurotic, highly strung, but very important to Wordsworth in terms of... No, being his, being his muse. Mm-hmm. You know, she was the sensibility, like she was romantic sensibility. And Wordsworth kind of used her eyes and her ears and her extraordinary kind of, her extraordinary sensitivity to her surroundings mm-hmm. for his poetry. Depended on her.
So what can we learn about from her writings, her diary, the Grasmere Journals? I mean, what can we learn about his work through her?
Well, I think we can... The Grasmere Journals are absolutely wonderful, and I recommend them to anyone who's going to the Lake District at all. I mean, they teach you how to read the Lake District. Wonderful little examples, like it was Dorothy who first saw the daffodils. So Dorothy describes seeing the daffodils in an absolutely beautiful piece of prose. I mean, her journals can be seen as kind of prose poems, if you like. In a beautiful piece of prose, she describes walking with Wordsworth and seeing these golden daffodils. And then Wordsworth, years later, kind of 3 or 4 years later, looking through her journals for something to write about. He says, oh, yes, the daffodils. And so he turns the experience that she'd recorded into his experience that he quite pointedly had alone. He wandered lonely as a cloud.
Yes, because they had the experience together at the time.
They had the experience together. I mean, what we learn from Dorothy's journals is that William was hardly ever alone. Mm-hmm. Hardly ever alone. He was almost always either with Dorothy or with Coleridge or with Dorothy and Coleridge. He was completely dependent on the non-stop conversation going on between them. And then when he married, he was always with Mary. But the myth of the romantic poet, as started by Wordsworth, was a man alone, a man singular and alone.
Was he sort of seeking that kind of, sort of at least a literary solitude if he couldn't get any actual solitude? Was it sort of a... something he was sort of losing himself in? Was that why he did it? I mean, was it more simple than that?
I don't think he really wanted actual solitude. Mm. I mean, he wanted solitude in as much as he didn't want to live in a town. He wanted to live in the country.
Right.
But I can't imagine him surviving completely alone for very long. Mm. I don't think he'd have known how to kind of, you know, to fry his pork chop or anything like that. I mean, he was very dependent on Dorothy to kind of keep the whole show going domestically, as well as dependent on her on her sensibility.
But in terms of, especially on her sensibility, do you think in a way that's... Her work is sort of undervalued because it's a lot of it is so, not lost in her brothers, but sort of it's so used by her brother it doesn't actually get the value it deserves?
Well, it's interesting because, I mean, in a sense, what does Dorothy's work amount to? It amounts to some journals that she kept entirely for her own pleasure and for her brother. And so, I mean, they were kind of published really by accident after her birth. And when people say, oh, you know, William prevented Dorothy from being a poet, well, no, he didn't. I mean, she wasn't a poet. Mm. You know, and in a sense, I mean, she had a richer life than really any other woman I can think of in that period. I mean, she managed to live an entirely bohemian life. Mm. She wasn't somebody's wife, and she wasn't sort of living in a parsonage somewhere, kind of serving tea and having dreary conversation. She was living in Dove Cottage with her brother and his astonishingly interesting friend, Coleridge, who would walk over the mountains to see them under the moonlight. And she was sitting up all night, talking and going to bed in the day if she felt like it, and living an entirely kind of unconventional, unexpected and surprising life filled with ideas.
Mm. I'm very interested by the bohemian thing. I was intrigued to see at the very end of your piece, you mentioned Thomas de Quincey's sort of presence. You wrote the Diaries of an Opium Eater.
Yes, Confessions of an English Opium Eater.
And it's surprising to me to think that this sort of small cottage in the middle of the Lake District was actually an opium den at some juncture.
I know. Well, it was. As I said, I've written two books about the cottage, and the first one was about Dorothy Wordsworth, the Ballad of Dorothy Wordsworth, it's called, and that was about Dorothy Wordsworth's journals. It was based around the journals that she wrote when she first moved to the cottage with William. And the second book, Guilty Thing, was about when Thomas de Quincey moved into the cottage. So I was always hugely amused by the fact that the Wordsworths turned Dove Cottage into a kind of shrine to Wordsworth's own genius.
Right.
Because, I mean, it was a shrine to his genius. He did his best work there. And they saw the cottage as a kind of as an almost a religious site. It was religiously intense, their life there. And then when they moved out, Thomas de Quincey, who was a super fan of Wordsworth's, moved in because they asked him to move in. He was a much younger man. They asked him to move in really as a custodian of the cottage. I mean, he was paying the rent. They didn't own it. They were just leasing it. He was paying the rent. And they wanted him to just kind of, you know, live in their hallowed cottage and love it as they had loved it and look after the garden that they had built and, you know, and look after, clean the windows that they had loved looking through. And De Quincey, I think, at first was very honoured to do this. I mean, he too worshipped Dove Cottage and he too worshipped Wordsworth. And then bit by bit, he got completely fed up with being patronised by them. And he was already taking laudanum. Lots of people took laudanum. Yeah. Coleridge was a famous laudanum addict. And after a while, he just sunk into his addiction there. Mm. So I thought, you know, that Wordsworth was so po-faced. And I thought it was very funny that...
It was a sacrilege in a way to them.
It was sacrilege and they simply couldn't bear it. Mm-hmm. They really couldn't bear that that he wasn't in their employ, if you like, that he was going to live in the house how he wanted to live in the house. Mm. And he was a druggie, and so he was going to turn the house into a drug den.
That seems to sort of betray a certain degree of, to use the word egomania is quite harsh, but there's a awareness of herself is like, of course, he's not going to live in it exactly the way you want it to. You know, I find that quite surprising thing for them to be able to expect.
Yeah. I don't think egomania is too harsh. I think Wordsworth was ego. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's one of the things that's most powerful about him, the enormity of his ego, the enormity of his drive and his self-belief. Mm-hmm. And that's what makes him great. Mm-hmm. I think that you feel this kind of... It surges and palpitates through his poetry. And Dorothy, of course, was there to kind of pump the ego up the whole time. And so, yes, it didn't occur to Wordsworth that a little midget like Thomas de Quincey, who was only 4'11", a little midget like Thomas de Quincey, who hadn't yet written anything, could be anything other than in the servant class. Mm-hmm, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So was Wordsworth not a particularly nice man then?
I don't think he was a nice man. Mm-hmm. No, but I don't think that great artists are nice people.
Sure.
I mean, that Lucian Freud doesn't seem to have been a very nice man either. And no, I don't think Wordsworth was nice at all. I think he was driven and committed, entirely dedicated to the importance of the work that he believed he had been put on earth to do, and.
I mean, that strong divine purpose in this.
I think so, yes. But the more, you know, the more you think about, you know, the personalities of strong writers, the more you realise how much their families suffered in order for that work to be produced. Mm-hmm. Because you're living around the high and low temperature of this, the person who's central to that community. And what's interesting about Dove Cottage, I think, is how tiny it is, how tiny it was to contain that huge intellect and all of that poetry coming out of those... It always seemed to me quite a creepy place. Mm-hmm. You know, those low ceilings and those walls slightly closing in.
Mm-hmm. But it does seem that his sister didn't... Was his relationship with her tense at times? Or it sounds, the way you phrased it, that completely devotional, as in sort of not they never had a bad moment almost.
No, I think it was very tense a lot of the time, particularly when Wordsworth decided that he had to marry. And what you find in Dorothy Wordsworth's journals, or what I found when I read her journals first, was that they weren't at all a kind of a record of sunsets and celandines living in Dove Cottage. They were a record of her sense of the clock ticking while she was living with Wordsworth, knowing that before long this idyll was going to end because he was going to get married. And so I think it was a period of great joy and great sadness because she knew that she couldn't hold on to it forever. I mean, he had a sex drive and he needed a wife. Mm-hmm. And Dorothy lived, I think, Dorothy also had a sex drive. It's interesting that people always think that Dorothy, because I think she's called Dorothy and people think that's the name of It's always the name of a virgin aunt, that Dorothy lived somehow without having the desires that other women had. But I think she really did, and I think she channeled them towards her brother. And I think there was a crisis between them, and you can feel this crisis in the Grosmere journals, that she doesn't even know what she's writing about half the time. She's using using nature and the turbulence of nature as a kind of metaphor for what she can't express or understand is going on between herself and her brother.
You mentioned that it's briefly, just jump on something you said a second ago, that it was sort of an idyll, it was an extraordinary life they lived. But something I was intrigued to note about Wordsworth's work is that supposedly when he was there, he wrote some of his darker poetry.
Yes, he did. And
it was more sort of death and sort of pain and grief. And are those two things linked, do you think?
Yeah, I think, I mean, one of the things he wrote when he was there, which has always really interested me, was he did a second edition of lyrical ballads. The lyrical ballads that he'd put together with Coleridge in Somerset, he kind of redid when he was in Dove Cottage, and it became a much darker volume. And he included in it what's known as the kind of the Lucy poems, where he imagines again and again and again the death of this girl, the death of this young girl whose body is kind of rolling around with rocks and stones and trees. And I think this is what you mean by the darker poems. And some critics have said this is his imagining the death of Dorothy. He can't bear the thought of the death of Dorothy. And what would he do without her? What would he do without her physical presence, but where would the poetry be without her?
Yeah.
And he also fell out with Coleridge while he was in Dove Cottage, and I think that that brought a kind of extra layer of darkness to his writing, that he sort of realised that this friendship that was so important to him and that was so important to the poetry simply wasn't going to survive. Coleridge was a much more fragile person than Wordsworth, and Wordsworth's strength as a poet was just getting almighty big. And so people were kind of being damaged by it.
In terms of his approach to his work, I mean, how did he go about it? I was very amused by the comment about Seamus Heaney, calling him the pedestrian poet. That sounded fantastic. Could you explain what that was?
Well, what Heaney meant, obviously there's a pun in it, but what Heaney was referring to was the fact that Wordsworth wrote his poems while he was walking. And so did Coleridge. And I think you can feel their different walks and their different rhythms, that Coleridge's poems come out of kind of rambling, really, you know, kind of collapsing through woods and kind of rolling down the sides of the sides of hills. And Wordsworth's poems were kind of paced into being, that locals would describe seeing Wordsworth walking up and down the garden path in Dove Cottage and walking up and down the road between Grosmere and Ambleside, kind of chanting the poems into being, with Dorothy scuttling along behind him, kind of writing it down. And apparently his walk was the kind of walk that edged other people to the side of the road. He took up too much space.
Right, yeah.
So he walked kind of... he walked into the hedgerow, if you like. And so Dorothy never quite knew how to position herself behind him. But this was where the work took place. Mm-hmm. And, of course, walking was so important to Wordsworth. I mean, the whole idea of walking as a kind of revolutionary act, you know, you walk out of conventional life into the life of the radical poet. And he and Dorothy walked everywhere, and he had walked across the Alps. So walking was really important for him, and it was an important image, but it was also just an important way of allowing his mind the freedom to think.
He did embrace the radicalism though, didn't he? Sort of, he kind of fell behind the French Revolution. He was quite sort of pro to begin with, no?
Well, he was young, and as he said, you know, bliss it was to be life that dawned to be young was very heaven. Now, he was young during the French Revolution, and everyone who was young during the French Revolution was caught up in its ideals. And then he became, you know, disenchanted when the French Revolution kind of got itself darker
But because, I was intrigued because the whole romantic sort of movement, it's very much a looking back, isn't it? It's looking at a sort of medieval past and the green. Is it? I mean, I might be completely wrong.
Yes.
In what I've heard, it seems quite sort of rooted in an element of conservatism at least. So it seems quite surprising to have those two side by side.
Yes. Well, Coleridge looked back to the kind of medieval past, and you can feel it in the language of the Ancient Mariner and Christabel. Wordsworth was much more interested in writing about his own past. Really, the only subject that interested him was himself. And, you know, the Prelude was the poem on the growth of his own mind, you know, and it was his life's work. He was profoundly conservative. I mean, the only elements of kind of radicalism, social radicalism, you can find in the work are, the poems he wrote about, itinerant people and homeless soldiers and mad mothers and idiot boys. Mm-hmm. And really, I think he was much less concerned with mad mothers and idiot boys and homeless soldiers, because he was, socially, then as subjects for poetry. He thought if he used these people as subjects for poetry, then you're making poetry into much more democratic.
He was very keen on the democratic sort of aspect, wasn't he? As well, especially in his use of language, isn't that right?
Yes. Yes, and well, he said he was, and it's always, I think, amused people that in the preface to the Lyrical Ballads, he says, you know, we've got to kind of radicalise the language of poetry, and we've got to radicalise, obviously, the subjects of poetry. The poetry cannot really entirely be about kind of classical themes. We have to write about, you know, ordinary people, and we have to write about ordinary people in ordinary language. I don't think anyone's found the language of Lyrical Ballads to be anything close to the language of everyday speech. I mean, it's still the language of poetry. And so Wordsworth did kind of fail in that sense. And Coleridge used the sort of the language of medieval knights.
Is he still relevant today?
It's a strange legacy. I think it's very, very hard to get young people to read Wordsworth now, because there's no sex in it. And
as simple as that.
I think it's as simple as that. I think people find the sex in Coleridge, because Coleridge, I mean, Christabel, for example, is about kind of lesbian vampires. And Coleridge is such a kind of palpitating human being. And you feel his humanity. But Wordsworth's coldness, I think, comes through in his poetry. And he's more moved by a stone than he is by a woman. Mm-hmm. And I think young people, you know, you learn to love your poets at school.
Right.
And when I was at school, I was alienated by Wordsworth. And I felt alienated by Wordsworth at university as well. The only thing that kind of brought Wordsworth into any kind of focus for me was my deep interest in Dorothy Wordsworth and Thomas De Quincey and Coleridge. So it was the people in the Wordsworth circle who I felt so close to that I thought, well, they found something in Wordsworth. So what was it? So I sort of come to him from the outside, if you like. But I think he's hard to feel anything but kind of awe around. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Do you think he was, that sort of detached aspect that he had, did it, was it taken badly? And do you think that that's why there's so much parody of him?
Yes. What you mean, the parody of the poems?
The mocking sort of.
Yeah, the poems are very, very easy to parody, because Wordsworth had no sense of humour. I mean, he has no sense of humour at all.
It can be taken to be quite portentous, I suppose.
But what people said, I mean, when Hazlitt first met Wordsworth, he said there was an inclination to laughter around the mouth when Wordsworth was a young man, and it's always struck me as odd. I mean, you never feel that Wordsworth was inclined to laugh. But he must have been at some point. But yes, I think the poetry's self-importance is very easy to parody.
I was going to say, actually, with sort of especially with the ego element, it seems almost that, you know, gets thinking of himself as being just that brilliant, he can't take,
yes.
There is no joke, because he genuinely is that good.
Well, he really is that brilliant, I'm afraid. especially what he wrote when he was in Dove Cottage was absolutely astoundingly brilliant, and kind of operating on that level of poetic power all the time must have been kind of extraordinary for them all. Imagine a composer producing his best works in this tiny condensed, in this tiny little space, in this tiny condensed time, and it is incredible, the energy that came out of the place. Mm-hmm.
So I think that's quite a good place to end, sort of brilliant but raging egomaniac. Yeah. William Wordsworth, everybody. And if I want to thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
You.
It's been a delight.